Welcome to this third and final portion of today's sixth CEU seminar regarding grieving with grace. We ended this last section of the seminar talking about the cognitive behavioral strategies, those which you're probably aware of if you've worked quite a bit in the field, are some of the most commonly used strategies and can be valuable, especially in the instances surrounding dealing with the bumper sticker answers, dealing with automatic negative thoughts, dealing with some of the anxious what ifs. And one of the things that I mention with my clients is a variation of that cognitive behavioral strategy, that watch where you put your butts. And again, highlight the importance of telling yourself the whole truth. Again, not denying all the personalized components of grief, the unpleasant feelings, concerns, worries, irrational thoughts or questions and doubts, but ending up with a positive self-statement or a strengths-based statement. This is where a solution-focused approach can really fit in. The idea of, I might not feel very strong. I might not feel very capable. This loss or this change in life might be something different than what I'm used to. But even in spite of that, I have managed other things in life and could possibly use some similar skills again. I've included a quote in your PowerPoint entitled Principles of the Fire, which I think really gives a sense of perspective that we can talk with our clients about. This quote says, if your house is on fire, the most urgent thing to do is to go back and try to put out the fire, not to run after the person you believe to be the arsonist. If you run after the person you suspect has burned your house will burn down while you're chasing him or her. This is not the action of a wise person. You must go back and put out the fire. When you're angry, you tend to interact with or argue with the other person. If you try to punish him or her, you're acting exactly like someone who runs after the arsonist while their house goes up in flames. Excuse me. What an interesting perspective. Sometimes we hyper-focus on the annoyances of life instead of looking at what's most needful, what's most important at this specific given time, which is what mindfulness techniques would really focus us on. One thing I did want to spend a little time on is this idea of really preparing what can other people around the person who's going through grief, loss, and mourning do. Sometimes people feel helpless. They don't know what to say. They don't know what not to say. But, you know, there are ways they can react that are more healthy. We've talked quite a bit today about why the bumper sticker answers are harmful and what not to do. But it is important to assist our clients in verbalizing what would be helpful, or assisting if we're working with systems types of stuff, like couples or family counseling, assisting others in understanding what helpful roles they could achieve. One of the first things they can do is affirming mattering, meaning that they are willing to hear the voice, the narrative, the complexities, and just the individualized way that this person is dealing with grief. Additionally, these other people can normalize emotions. They can give a feeling word. Wow, sounds like you feel such and such, sad, caught off guard, questioning, challenged about how to make sense of this. Helping them realize that they're not alone, that some of the feelings, struggles, questions, doubts that many people go through when they're grieving are part of the human experience and are shared or common humanity. They can allow the other to have a voice. Another thing that's particularly helpful is what I call the communication game. There's three parts that the person on the receiving end, observing or listening to the person grieving, can listen for. One would be the person's feelings. The second one would be their perception of how the situation happened. That could be like if there was an imaginary video camera. What did it actually see? What is it that the client perceived? And the third part that a listener could look at is what goals might be desired in the future. It's very affirming and validating to the person grieving when they feel someone is hearing that. So the article I cited from 2011 that I put good grieving in terms of therapy talks about the elements that really make grief counseling effective with our clients. One is when we are able to put our counseling in the context of grief as part of a human experience rather than some horrible thing to be mended. So again, we kind of depathologize grief. We focus on the good that can come out of even the uncomfortable. This assists in that meaning making that we talked about earlier. Another thing that is helpful is when we maintain a solution focus. We focus on in spite of change, in spite of things not always happening in a predictable manner, that there's strengths, that there's ways we can deal with things. Good grief therapy addresses the images and thoughts, separation, feelings of grief, and it allows our clients to narrate the story as they see it. We provide that safe, comfortable setting in the office to do so. Good grief also may increase a sense of spirituality in spite of loss, and it instills the hope that the story is ongoing. In terms of providing grief therapy, as I alluded to earlier, there's a plethora of different types of feelings that may come up, including things like anger, a sense of injustice, hurt or pain, the very real sadness. And that could be on a continuum of a little sad to absolutely devastated. Sometimes it's useful to really understand on that continuum where our client is seeing their happy, sad, angry. Is it just a little sad or just devastated? My world is upside down. Other feelings can be betrayal. Clients have expectations of what they thought should happen in a relationship. And when it happens differently, there may be a sense of betrayal, sadness, confusion, bewilderment, feeling upset, feeling disappointed or let down, maybe even hatred, rage, frustration, or depression. Now, I wanted to bring up a few considerations when we're working with children. Children, in general, are a specialized population in terms of doing counseling. So the work we do may be best approached somewhat differently than working with adults. When we're working with children, we need to consider that individual child's personality, his or her developmental age. Just because biologically they may be literally a certain age, they may or may not emotionally be at that age. There may be some skills they lag behind on. There may be some things where they seem advanced to their age, and we really need to be honed in with that. Another huge thing that the literature talks about is what is a given child's family or support network? What do they do? How does this sense of community around the child process grief? Kids largely imitate what they see around them. Think of even an infant when we talk about attachment issues. If they see their mom or dad panicking when they're trying to walk and they bump into something, they may start crying and panicking too. But if they see the parent laugh and say, "Wow, you can do it," and try and help them up and encourage them again, they may have a little more optimism. It's the same with grief. If they see mom, dad, community around them really avoiding talking about grief, going about day-to-day life but not referring to what happened, having this sense that we can't talk openly, that gives a certain message to a child. On the other hand, if that child sees the parent sometimes tearful, sometimes sorting through, having real human feelings, and having a place to process those, that gives a different message. One thing we have to realize as professionals is the literature shows that fears of loss, whether it's death, whether it's injury or change, are huge for children. When they've surveyed children, 75% of children, 3/4 of the children surveyed, had significant fears about what might happen next in their life. What if a loved one wasn't around? What if they had to move? What if there was change in their life and the way things are done in day to day? One of the things to keep in mind is that play is a child's language. So play therapy often can be a good technique to work with children. The way you set up your office is important. You want to have a variety of types of furniture, seating choices, things like comfy furniture, bean bags, and a child-centered atmosphere. You want to be able to have different tools that will allow for various modalities to be used in terms of play. This can include things like dolls, puppets, coloring books, crayons, markers, pencils. Other things you might not traditionally think of that I include are things like bubbles. When I teach my kids, my clients, relaxation, we learn relax, slow breathing. And I use the analogy of blowing bubbles and how we can't blow bubbles very fast. Doesn't work too well. So sometimes having bubbles in the therapy office can be helpful. Balloons. There's things that they can blow up a balloon. They can write on the balloon or let it go. Books. Bibliotherapy can be helpful. Things like blocks. Another thing the literature talks about in terms of play therapy is the idea of actually having a therapy contract with a child. It helps that child feel respected. It helps him or her realize that they're an active part in therapy and designing things. Naming and normalizing feelings is a very important skill for kids because, again, in their lives, they may or may not have seen this happen with the adults in the community around them. An exercise that many kids find helpful is the exercise of making paper plate faces. So having tools like paper plates and art supplies. Another artistic variation that works with kids is body mapping. I've seen some of these work with adults too. So I'm not saying it's just kids, but when we're looking specifically at kids, these can be things they tend to gravitate to. So with body mapping, you can use large white paper and basically draw the outline of the child. Then they can use art supplies, glue, crayons, cutout shapes, sequins, colors, buttons, things to design themselves as a person. And you can use this for several different things in therapy. You can use it to identify where in their body they're storing their stress, their sadness, their anger. It could be in their head for memories. Maybe they have headaches. Maybe their hands or their feet get tight and they feel like punching or kicking something when they're upset. Maybe their stomach growls or feels like it hurts when they think about certain things. Then you can use relaxation strategies to help de-escalate some of those physiological reactions. A variation that can be helpful with kids is also called mutual storytelling. This narrative approach can really be done with adults as well. With mutual storytelling, we hear what's significant in terms of what the client says is significant, and then we help over the course of the narrative to help them decide and feel empowered about choosing various alternative endings. The basic thing we want to convey to clients is that they're able to modify who the characters are. Maybe the story initially surrounding the grief didn't go the way they wanted, but they're able now for the next chapters after the mourning and the grief and loss to decide how frequent they might want to interact with a given person, what they'd like the setting to be, what wishes, hopes, dreams, or goals from here they'd like, and what they want the next chapter to be. We can assist them in mutual storying by helping them reframe their choices and assist in expression of their needs. Another technique that can help in terms of restorying with clients, but would have to be done in a safe setting, is called the candle technique. This also can be used in some grief groups. The candle technique, each person would light a candle representative of his or her life. So each candle represents one life. Each life lights a flame. But the idea is presented to clients that flames can light other flames. It basically highlights how others impact each other, to where the room is brightened when each light touches another light. Another thing that can be used, as I alluded to before, especially in groups, but can be used as well individually, is the use of photos. What's significant as we talk with the client is the client's selection of which photos they choose to pick out, what topics those photos tend to be about. Overall, in terms of the client's collection of photos, what is it made up of? And then in a group context, how do they have those dynamics of sharing the narrative surrounding the photos, and how do they interpret what's going on in the photos? A few people could look at the same photo and have a different narrative surrounding it, or a different restorative narrative of what they want to happen from here. Then what can happen in the group, which is so neat to watch if you're ever a part of it, is to see how the group sorts out various photos that they bring in. What photos and narratives, what commonalities, what differences do they have? And how they go through applying this meaning-making attempt as well. Things that can be done in terms of this photo-based therapy are, first of all, titling the photo. That's fascinating to me to see how they, decide to attribute things to the picture. Second, you can discuss what is it that is being portrayed. So how do they describe it? Third, how does this relate to the group? Are there commonalities? Are there differences? Are there specific, unique things? For example, if there's someone who says, well, my grief was unique, my person or situation was a sudden loss. It involved a crime. It was a media case. Or mine was a completed suicide. Or mine was disenfranchised grief, loss of a hope or a dream. So how many people in the grief group may share the same issues versus maybe having some differences? A fourth thing that can be brought up is, why does this client believe the problem or situation exists? Fifth, how could this image educate others? And sixth, what would we like to do about the problem or situation? So one of the things I wanted to look at in this next section, which again is so significant for most of our clients, is how to just identify and normalize the client's feelings. To me, that may sound like such a simple thing to us, because those of us who've worked in the field for a while have been doing this so long. But we can't say enough about the importance of Rogers process variables, empathy, listening, and hearing that client's narrative. I can't tell you how many times someone said to me, "Wow, I feel like you're the only person in my life who really listens." So let's look at these scenarios and see what we can pick out that might be significant. Number one, "I can't believe that my friend, who I've known since childhood, did that. After all those years, I never would have guessed. I thought I knew him better. How could I ever trust him again when I didn't even see this coming?" Now, on purpose, I didn't identify what the issue was that caught this person off guard. But I think we can nonetheless identify and relate to this client to say, "Wow, you really felt caught off guard. You've known this person a long time, and you really thought in this situation he or she would have done A, B, and C. But gosh, you're not sure." One word that was significant in the narrative was trust. I think it's important to hear clients' operational definitions of things. And sometimes when we're talking about mourning, grief, loss, maybe even betrayal, trust can be a significant thing. I would probably explore with this client their concrete behavioral definitions of what they thought trust was or meant in this or other relationships, and what trust would look like from here. What would have to happen? Are there possible behavioral requests they could make from people if they're considering relationships in the future? Let's look at the second scenario. "I thought my home would be a safe place, but I found out it wasn't. If it wasn't for my mom's boyfriends coming in and having their way with me, then it was the domestic fights between my mom and dad, and I never got the opportunity to live in a quiet, safe neighborhood either. If not violence inside, there were random gunshots and crimes outside. I never knew where I was safe. I still don't know what safe is. How will I ever know? Life is awful and unsafe. No one can be trusted. And trying to be the good kid in school and at home doesn't help either. Even if you study hard, clean your room, and behave, you're abused. Life is unfair and cruel." A lot of emotion in this narrative, huh? A lot of different things that could be picked out. The first thing that comes to mind is unpredictability. The thread or the theme through all of this is, I don't know from moment to moment what's going to happen. I might also hear some anxiety, a lot of what if, what next? You know, if not for one bad thing here, there's another bad thing on this other side. So maybe asking the client, "Tell me what safe would be," might not be a good question when they feel like they've only known what's unsafe. They've only known what's unpredictable. Tell me about how you survived just feeling like you have to jump through moment to moment, hurdle to hurdle. So we're talking about anxiety, unpredictability, lack of safety. sadness, depression. There may even be a sense of just suck it up. Do what you need to do. You got school and home life. Be responsible. There may be anger about some of the messages of shoot. I faced a lot, but I did the right things and life just gave me more. I also see the end about life is unfair and cruel. Those are two things we could also explore with this client. What was life supposed to be? What was the narrative I would have liked? And what has it been? There may be a real sense of deep injustice on this child's part of, well, why do I get this? Why do some people have broken families? Why are some people repeatedly abused? Why did I even try and make an effort to do the quote-unquote right things, but still more hurt came? Life isn't fair. Let's look at this very short example, this number three. I can never do anything right. I try so hard, but it seems I always fail. I put all my into my things, but they never work out. Again, I purposely kept this one vague for you guys. So a sense of letdown. Possibly for this client, there might be a sense of push and pull. I try. Why in the world? Evaluating, why do I keep trying? My trying's not good enough. There could be a lot of cognitive behavioral work we could even do with this person. Whatever this enough supposedly is. Things don't work out. Maybe there's some assumptions on this client's part of what, quote, working out would look like. What about this fourth example? She was never there for me, but she was my mom after all. I had to raise myself, even as a young child. I cooked food and took care of my brothers and sisters while she was out on the streets doing her thing. I cleaned the house so no one could tell me how bad things really were. I had to grow up before my time. I never got to be a kid. Why did Mom get to do as she pleased, but I had to be the grown-up when she wasn't even acting like a grown-up herself? Now I missed out on so much, and I'm angry and bitter. It's a lot of feelings. And one of the things to note as we go through these narratives is that some of the feelings are stated directly. At the end of this, you hear from this person, I'm angry and bitter. There's a lot of resentment there. There's this sense of, I had to grow up before my time. Why is there one set of rules for my parent, but not, you know, the same for me? Responsibility only matters if you're a kid, but not as an adult. You can be as irresponsible as you want. You know, that's confusing. And I might even use that word with a client and say, oh, tell me, are you feeling confused? In addition to the anger and resentment that you feel like there's a double standard here. Let's look at this fifth scenario. My biological parents gave me up for adoption. Now they want to meet me. They said they were young and did what they believed was the best chance for me in life. But growing up not knowing who you really are or why you're unwanted does not feel like the best chance to me. They expect me to just forgive and move on. Though I went through so much self-doubt, rejection, and abandonment. They were living their lives. They didn't try. They didn't make me a priority. So there's a lot of thoughts and feelings of being brushed aside. Especially when I hear this person's narrative, they expect me to just forgive and move on. Even when I went through self-doubt, rejection, and abandonment. There's a lot of assumptions and areas where this person filled in the narrative of, well, they weren't there, so they must not have tried. And this is a common wrestling that people who have gone through adoption go through, especially when there's loopholes. This is part of that disenfranchised type of grief where it's like, I don't get all the pieces to the story, and I might never get all the pieces to the story. So hearing the anger, hearing that things are open-ended, hearing the questions. Let's look at the sixth example. My bosses are always against me. I have been on 20 jobs in the last year. They always find something to fire me for. They let other people get away with things, but not me. I'm sure the next boss will just be the same. You can only get ahead in life if you're the best friend of the company owner. So we see, in terms of action, that there's been a lot of change in this person's life. 20 jobs in a year is a great, great deal of change. They're starting and stopping a job, you know, even within days or weeks. But there's this narrative, and sometimes it might be unrealistic, that everyone's against me. That can be tricky for us because there can be a tendency to want to correct and challenge that narrative off the bat. But it's important to start with a narrative of where our client's at. What is it that they feel is unfair? Where do they want to be heard? I remember actually having a client years ago who pretty much was in this boat. And he said, well, gosh, no one ever listens to my ideas. I have plenty of things I'd like to say about what could help or what could make a difference at the factory I work at. And so instead of reprimanding him or trying to challenge some of his anger outbursts that had been documented by his company, I first heard, you know, so tell me a little bit about what you want them to hear. What have they not heard? And then we worked on skills of how do you share a message so that it could be heard. What was interesting is by the end of our anger management counseling, this guy actually ended up having some really useful meetings with the company he worked for. And they did take some of his suggestions into consideration, and he found out at that last job, the current one that he had when he met me, that maybe someone could listen to him. Maybe it was more about how he said things or presenting those. So my role as a counselor ended up being one of how can I support him in increasing the likelihood of his hope that he would be heard, that he would be valued, even if he's not an executive in the company, but that he would be seen as someone with experience eventually or with ideas or perspectives that could be helpful. Let's look at the seventh example before we move on to some other areas about loss and grief. Every day is another surprise. All of my friends are dying. I have one loss after another. Life gives me more than my share of issues. There's no end in sight. Other people get a break, but not me. I guess some people get lucky and some people never get anything. So this person probably is going to be struggling with meaning making, unfairness. I might want to focus on the narrative of what they hoped would happen. The sense of surprise, their sense of, wow, really sounds like you bet on certain things happening a certain way, but that life really turned out very differently. Now, the next part of what I wanted to talk about in today's seminar might seem interesting to you. You might think, well, how does this fit in? I want to talk about offenses and forgiveness, because oftentimes I found when we're talking about mourning, loss, and grief, that there's this sense of, I wanted life to go one way, and at least in part, it turned out a different way. we can feel like we're on the receiving end of being offended. In addition, we also can feel like there may be areas where we've done certain things or had regrets and want to redo behaviors. So I've cited some research and a book that's phenomenal by Dr. Janice Abram Spring, who talks about the four types of reactions to offenses. And first of all, one thing I tend to go over with my clients is that we're all both offender and offended. None of us is just on the receiving end of offenses, though it may feel that way in the moment sometimes. And none of us is just dishing out all awful stuff all the time. So she talks about four reactions. One is cheap forgiveness. The second is refusing to forgive. The third is acceptance, and the fourth is forgiveness. So I want to explain these different reactions. And I usually educate my clients and talk with them about the pros and cons of each. Obviously, the decision's ultimately theirs in terms of how they want to process an offense, but there are ups and downs to each option. One of the best things we can do for our clients sometimes is reminding them, you have options, you have choices. So the first of those four that I refer to was called cheap forgiveness. The idea is that basically, okay, I take a quick action. It's kind of like a cognitive type of decisional mental forgiveness. It's really a premature forgiveness. Okay, I'll change, or I'll sweep it under the rug, or okay, fine, yeah, whatever, I'll hear it. This is considered inauthentic because the person on the receiving end hasn't done any processing through the depth of the layers of emotions, the multitude of emotions, all the different co-occurring parts of the narratives. To give an example, I remember there was a gentleman years ago I counseled, and he had suddenly found a card that was given for Valentine's Day from a gentleman to his wife. His wife had been having an affair with this gentleman, and the wife did not come clean to him, did not tell him she was having an affair, didn't make mention that she wanted to stop the affair, wanted to work on the marriage. But my client, the husband, ended up coming in for hurt, sadness, betrayal, shock, a lot of different mourning and loss elements. But his approach, he kept saying, but I want to be a good Christian example to her. I want to show her that I can move beyond this. And so his response fell in this category of cheap forgiveness. He made a decisional, cognitive effort to say, okay, now that I know about it, we've talked about it. She told me she had an affair because she liked the way he looked better than I looked. He did this differently than I did. Okay, I'll just change and it'll be better. I was deeply concerned. I told him, I said, I appreciate that you want to work through and grow with your wife, but sometimes when there's not a level of a long-term back and forth about the factors that have led up to the affair, and there's not a dialogue and a real working through and thorough plan of actions, it can set people up for delayed or complicated grief. It can set them up for potential health and emotional problems. He said that his wife basically made it clear she never intended for him to find out about the affairs, but now that it was out in the open, okay, she would just say she wouldn't do it again. And so he said, okay, well, I'll just believe her and we're going to move on. She wasn't willing to go to any counseling, whether with me or someone else. She wasn't willing to really talk more with him about it or work through. So the cheap forgiveness can really complicate mourning, loss, and grief. A second approach some people use is that of refusing to forgive. when someone thinks, oh gosh, the offense is just too far-fetched, that reconciling might be unhealthy, might not be possible, or refusing to forgive may happen when someone thinks, you know what, I want to send a clear message for this person to realize that I am not going to just take their behavior. Refusing to forgive is control and punishment based. The person on the receiving end feels like they can't do anything about it. We see this a lot with people who have all or none polarized thinking. Now, the third and fourth options are what I'd consider more in the realm of what we think of typically as forgiveness. Acceptance doesn't mean acceptance, like agreement of the action that the person took. It's not saying, okay, fine, I'm fine with what you did, or it doesn't bother me. It's allowing oneself to feel all the emotions and not bypassing the emotional work of the wounded party. There's a working through. There's learning healthy self-care. There's learning assertiveness and boundaries. But sometimes it's just not reasonable to have that other party in the sessions. For example, what if you have a client who's a victim of an abusive situation? We certainly have an ethical responsibility to be protective of that person. We wouldn't want a possible active abuser involved with this person, or to put them at more risk emotionally, physically, sexually, in any possible way. Reconciliation might not be the healthiest option in that situation. But what acceptance does, again, not agreeing with the offense, but putting in context the narrative. Oh gosh, this person did this and that, said this and that to me, maybe because that's all they knew. Again, it doesn't excuse it. It doesn't tolerate it. But it relieves that client of unnecessary guilt and blame. And it places things in context. The last type of forgiveness is what Dr. Janice Abrams Springs calls genuine forgiveness. She calls this an intimate dance between the offender and offended. In ideal situations where we can work with both parties, there's a recognition on each person's part of what offenses they've done and what they would like to be the commitment to a new future. There is work through. It may take some time. There's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of struggle with meaning making. There's a commitment on the part of both parties to assess the injury together and to reprocess it, to restory it. When I work with clients, especially, let's say, in marriage counseling, about what they want from here after they feel a wrong or an indiscretion has happened, I talk about the idea that if they're choosing this option of genuine forgiveness, that it's going to usually be a long, detailed process. There's going to be a lot of emotions. But ultimately, we want to look at a plan of action of what specific behavioral commitments each is willing to make. This is not just something that happens automatic, but it's worked for. The forgiveness is earned. It is conditional. There are standards. There are expectations. There's nothing wrong with boundaries. Boundaries can be some of the most loving things, and that may be something we need to teach our clients about. So in genuine forgiveness, the offender expresses genuine remorse and a specific plan to avoid certain behaviors in the future. There also may be some proactive plan for what the new behaviors would entail. There's a detailed discussion of parts of the pain without debating, cutting off, and correcting. And then finally, there's behavioral requests of what do we do from here. So as part of this process, usually I need to teach clients the idea of what constitutes a good apology. A good apology isn't just brushing off something, saying, yeah, I'm sorry for whatever you're offended about. But there's a sense of responsibility on each person's part for his or her side of things. Also, a good apology is personal. It's empathic. It's validating. That person is able to put a word on it of, oh, when this certain situation happened, you felt such and such. You needed this certain thing, but actually you got this other instead. That affected you such and such way. The person is able to understand what the hoped for future is. There is a specific plan for the future. What will we do when there's triggers again? A good apology is a deep apology. It's not a surface level apology. And genuine actions follow through that are congruent with it. There's not a lot of, I'm sorry, but. One of the things that we also work on in terms of moving beyond offenses is helping inspire hope in our clients. This can also assist them in going through the meaning-making process. We cannot underestimate what an impact it makes in terms of what they do with us in a therapeutic context. There's a type of connection in terms of the restoring and creating a positive narrative that makes a difference in a client's life. Through the helping process, emotions within the client are processed, and eventually there's more release. Through assisting the client, they're able to come up with alternative endings. So Cutliff, in his research, talks about what are some of the hopeful elements. And this is important in terms of doing the grieving with grace. Moving beyond those emotions that we talked about, the searching, the shock, the disorganization, eventually to a sense within the client of, I can choose hope. I can choose between options. So one of the hopeful elements is connectedness, support systems, connectedness within myself, really being congruent with who I am and what's a healthy self-identity and self-care, as well as connectedness to others. Who are my support systems? What do I need? How do I get that? Another element of hope is finding hopeful, uplifting memories. Many of our clients will say that even within things that just don't feel the greatest, that if they can find some aspects they can pull out, that they can find gratitude, thanksgiving, or blessing in, it can balance some of the overwhelming, unpleasant feelings. Another element that clients find hopeful is when we have practical strategies, especially the cognitive behavioral strategies, to help them assign a percentage to how likely is this automatic thought really, this negative, awfulizing, and catastrophizing. What other ways can I perceive it? What would be more realistic and more life-giving? Spiritual beliefs or philosophical beliefs can support hope. Refocusing and choosing how to spend their time and energy can support hope. I find that for many of our clients, they tend to just refocus on non-helpful elements when they're in a struggle. So one of the things is just helping them to redecide what they're going to focus their time and energy on. Both having a sense of direction and purposeful activities can help, as well as mindfulness, sometimes balancing that doing and being, sometimes just learning to be in the moment and not have to do more, sort more, make sense of more. Resilience, as we talked about a little bit before, is another hopeful element because it helps us to tolerate the ebb and flow of life. And ultimately, an atmosphere of acceptance. Not necessarily agreement, but acceptance of the fact that life can pass through. I don't have to scrutinize everything. Sometimes it just is. So there's several techniques. In addition to some of those we talked about, I always like to layer on a strengths orientation or solution focus. One of the key phrases we can use with clients is, how did you manage in spite of blah, blah, blah? This especially works well when you have a client who's been through layers and layers of things or traumatic things. I might say, wow, you're still getting up in the morning. You're still holding down a job. They may not feel like they're doing it successfully. They may not feel like they're conquering things or that they're quote-unquote strong. They might not even feel like they're managing. But when I say to them, gosh, some people struggle to even get out of bed. Some people, struggle to even bathe themselves. And they're like, wow, I didn't think of that. It makes a difference to our clients. It plants that seed of there is a life beyond the presenting concern that they're coming to counseling with. Sometimes we can help them look at what are the good things, find exceptions even in the midst of the pain. We can assist them in discovering their strengths, maybe personality attributes or ways they can endure, or building on strengths they already have, finding those positive memories. Martin Seligman years ago talked about learned helplessness, but he also more recently talked about learned optimism. And we know that optimism is not just a personality attribute that people have or don't have, but it's something that can be cultivated. So there's actually very specific criteria and elements that are there in terms of resiliency when we study who is it that bounces back from uncomfortable life experiences. Well, people who perceive setbacks as temporary, as local, time, oriented, and changeable. Those who keep persisting at tasks. Maybe it's not working now. Maybe I just need to practice more. Maybe I need to get the hang of this. They tend to do better. Those with new and different ideas. Sometimes one way might not be the best solution, but wow, when someone grapples with meaning making, they might find some different options and ideas. And wow, I use the phrase with my clients a lot of times, that's a consideration. Not everything might be an ideal consideration for our client, but if they can explore among a continuum of possible solutions, they can find the ones that are best in their given situations. Those who bounce back also are able to look beyond the initial opposition. They are able to mentally separate the heat of the moment and the stresses from their life decisions. They're able to identify those toxic cognitions and beliefs and behaviors and change it. So what we want to move a client towards is what Brené Brown talks about in her phrase, wholehearted living. There's elements that you can see in your PowerPoint that I've listed that she talks about as elements of wholehearted living. When our clients come to us about their presenting concerns, they don't feel like they're living. They might even feel like they're barely getting by. Life's routine at best, that it's a struggle. But over time, with this work that we do, when we help them grieve with grace, we are instrumental in partnering with them towards this wholehearted living. One, we cultivate authenticity. We help our clients let go of what all the other opinions are out there, of what everybody else thinks. I tend to say to clients, oh, what made that person an expert in this? So what makes that person or that group of people the experts? Is there another way of looking at it? We also help our clients cultivate self-compassion. We help them be merciful towards themselves and let go of perfectionistic ideas. We help them cultivate a resilient spirit. They're no longer powerless. Yes, things may have happened that were not anticipated or wanted. Maybe life is not the life I signed up for or wanted. But they have a resilient spirit. They find gratitude and joy, even in the midst of the dark. Remember the parable of the cave? Where the opening, that person worked so hard to build mounds of stones to try and get to some opening that he or she thought was in the ceiling, but it was actually right in front of them. That in the dark was the solution. Sometimes in the dark is our solution also. Another element of wholehearted living is cultivating intuition and faith. Oftentimes people struggle, especially with the anxiety part of grief and mourning and loss. But part of the skill they learn through counseling is dealing with letting go of the need for certainty. Especially towards that end, I use the Serenity Prayer to look at, yeah, there's some things I can control and there's some I can't. How do I cope with what I cannot control? Is there anything good, which I believe there is, at sometimes not having control over every aspect of life? Another aspect of wholehearted living that makes a difference is to cultivate creativity. I don't have to compare myself and my style of working through grief to someone else's. I can have my own style. I can look at what's workable for me. This next one I like because so many of our clients forget it in the moment. I can cultivate play and rest. This ties in with mindfulness. This ties in with this permissions of grieving. I can allow myself to enjoy life. I don't have to feel a sense of regret for actually doing something fun or life-giving. I can cultivate calm and stillness. I can cultivate meaningful work. I can cultivate laughter, songs, dances, things that just are playful. So when she defines wholehearted living, she says, there's a sense of simultaneously being imperfect and failing, yet still worthy of love. Seeing vulnerability as something necessary and desirable to create genuine intimacy in relationships. There's the courage to risk failure and heartbreak. There's willingness to feel authentically what I feel in the here and now. So it boils down to vulnerability. She says in one of her books, we wake up every day loving someone who may or may not love us back, whose safety we can't ensure, who may stay in our lives or may leave without a moment's notice, who may be loyal to the day I die or betray us tomorrow. That's vulnerability. Love is uncertain. It's incredibly risky. And loving someone leaves you emotionally exposed. Yes, it's scary, And yes, we're open to being hurt. But how can you imagine your life without being loving or being loved? Vulnerability means being capable of being wounded, open to attack or damage. So through being vulnerable, we deal with the fear of the unknown. One author states, many of us prefer practices that will not cause discomfort. Yet, at the same time, we want to be healed. But it doesn't work that way. A warrior accepts that we can never know what will happen to us next. We can try to control the uncontrollable by looking for the security and predictability, always hoping to be comfortable and safe, but the truth is, we can never avoid uncertainty. This not knowing is part of the adventure, and it's also what makes us afraid. This I, who wants something to hold on to, can finally learn to grow up. I wanted to give a few more ideas here, and then we're going to finish with some more grief scenarios as we wrap up today and learning to kind of combine everything that we've talked about thus far. One other tool I wanted to offer you that can be especially used primarily in a grief setting, but you could do it in an individual counseling setting, is called the ribbon activity. So what you would do is you would have a basket with various cut ribbons. Each ribbon would represent different aspects of the grieving process. So, for example, if you had a sudden loss or change in your life that you never expected, pick a black ribbon. If you had a loss that involved a trauma or threat to your own life or someone near you, pick a red ribbon. If you had a loss that involved a health issue that was prolonged, that eventually someone died, pick a blue ribbon. So there's so many different colors of ribbon, and each person selects the ribbons that apply to what they're feeling at a given time. Just like the photo exercise earlier, the ribbons give a chance for discussion of some of the common humanity as well as some of the differences. Now, as we wrap up, I'm going to share some more grief scenarios, and we can look at how to combine some of the different tools we learned about today. This first scenario is the one of Sherry. Sherry and Mike had just recently begun having discussions about plans for his retirement. Even before the two had children, their plan was always to work as much as possible early on so Mike could retire early. They planned to enjoy country life and spoke about how they'd like to convert the acres of farmland, guest property, and house into their dream retreat. Sherry worked hard at the local courthouse in secretarial and filing. One day her husband suddenly became ill. He began having unusual sinus symptoms and struggled to breathe. One of their adult daughters took him to urgent care at that point. A chest x-ray was done and multiple tests were run. In spite of not having the results, Mike was sent home and encouraged to follow up Monday morning, 4 days away from then, with a specialist. Monday, Sherry received the shock of a lifetime from her daughter while at work. Mike did not make it to the specialist. Before that could happen, he started gasping for breath, became dizzy, and fell to the floor. 911 was called, and he was transported to a nearby ER. Mike's oxygen levels became extremely low very quickly, and within a few hours, he died of an unknown respiratory disease. Only later was Sherry told that this was likely a case of COVID symptoms not being properly identified and treated. In a matter of minutes, Sherry and Mike's dreams and plans disappeared. The man she could not imagine life without was suddenly no longer around. There would be no more dreaming and planning for the retreat. Anger at the doctors for not having her husband sent to an ER Thursday night, but telling him to wait for a specialist Monday morning set in. Questions flooded her mind. At every turn, there were more questions than answers. Sherry also began blaming herself. What would I have done if I took him in Thursday instead of my daughter? Might I have insisted on him going to the ER sooner? What if I would have just left work to be with him Thursday? What if I called off and just was home Monday to take him to the specialist? What more could have been done? Questions continued to arise in Sherry's mind. How would I learn to do what Mike had done for so many years? How, after decades together, could she suddenly be okay with not seeing him or not doing life with her partner? How would she handle the hopes and dreams vanishing? If she could have been less afraid about losing her job and went with her husband to get him care, even the boss did not understand, would he be here today? Backlogged with cases and undone work, Sherry's boss made it clear that there was no room for extra time off beyond those 3 standard days. Not only did Sherry's boss have something to say, but it seemed as if all her neighbors, relatives, and friends had their comments. For example, some said she should just be happy about the time she had with Mike. Others told her just trust in God's grace. Many minimized the shock and pain she felt. She heard advice from every direction. Some told her to get out more. Others told her to just accept her husband was now in a better place. How would you work with Sherry? What would your treatment plan include? A lot of different elements there. I think the first thing I would do would be to give her those permissions to grieve as she needs to grieve. I would highlight the nonlinear nature of grief. I would highlight that grief is individualized and that I would like, as her therapist, to tailor each session to what she needs at that given time. I would give her permission to ask herself, maybe even multiple times a day, what do I need right now? Even if she didn't know what she needs, I would allow her permission to talk about what she doesn't want or what's not helpful with her, like the time limits, the criticisms from people at work or from neighbors and friends. Sounds like she's under a lot of pressure of getting back to work, of getting back to, quote, her typical life. So I think we'd have to do a lot of cognitive behavioral intervention. Now, one of the real struggles I know a lot of our clients go through is like, well, great, I need more time off. And if I do that, though, I can't make my bills. This is a real struggle for a lot of our clients. So sometimes it's a matter of finding out if they have FMLA benefits where they can take some time off. Or if they don't have those benefits to take some time off, what options do they have? What's possible? We might have to, in connection with other mental health professionals, medical doctors, write up about how the symptoms are impacting someone and what's needed in terms of time to get used to counseling, to apply skills. If there need to be some work adjustments or accommodations, that might be something that we need to recommend as well. We see a lot of meaning-making attempts and searching behavior. What if this? What if that? What if she had done A, B, and C? You know, would it be different? And I would want to normalize with her the search for meaning making. But one of the things I often talk with clients about is how to make a shift between why questions that are natural but not necessarily helpful to how and what, which are more goal-oriented. What do I need? How can we get there? What would I like from now? Let's look at our next scenario here regarding Mary. Mary enjoyed being a mom. In fact, in her book, it was one of the most fulfilling things in life. After her third child, she and her husband decided to actively plan for the next child. She was meticulous about eating healthy, planning for possible issues, and taking seriously self-care for the sake of her child. During her 21st week of gestation, she was suddenly informed that her baby had very little chance of living, and that the fluids that should protect his little organs were not there. If she went one more week, there was an 80% chance that if he survived, at this point, he'd be a vegetable. This wasn't the life she wanted for him. Yet she wondered how she could imagine life without him. She thought they were in the safe zone after 20 weeks. She and her husband had been preparing the house and children for the new baby brother. Now all she has left is a recording of her baby's heartbeat and a stuffed animal bear named after him. Her other children, who meanwhile ask questions, "Where's the crib for this baby? How much longer are we waiting?" She's unsure how to respond to her children's comments, much less her own thoughts and concerns. Lately, she's been thinking that if she and her husband will get pregnant again, it would be a source of great comfort to her. But her husband's not so sure. He's ready for the emotional roller coaster of the unpredictability of another pregnancy, and a long-term commitment of another child. How would you approach this client? There's a lot of different things here that are significant. Again, I always think with every client, we want to normalize the feelings, the concerns, the real sense of common humanity of struggling with, this is something I want, but life didn't turn out the way I hoped. We may want to help process that thought of, I did what I thought were the good, right, perfect things, and I tried to do them very well and very hard, but they still didn't turn out well. How do I cope with that? There's room to give those permissions again about allowing herself to grieve. The one thing I want to draw your attention to is at the end, and this is very common that sometimes in the midst of the grief, that sometimes a spouse or someone else may have a very different grieving pattern. So for her, eventually, she thought, well, maybe we try again for another child. Her husband was thinking, oh, I'm not so sure about that. This has been a rough road just dealing with this loss. And we have the other kids already. So that oftentimes can be a factor we deal with of how to deal with grief the way that's best for our given client when others in the system may need different things. Her children, especially the really young ones who really had no sense about death and dying and loss, asked practical questions about, oh, there's nobody in the crib. Well, what's the timing? The countdown's on. When's the baby going to be here? And so those would elicit more grief for her, but the youngest children were so young that they really didn't understand that. Her husband had his own style of grieving. She had her own style of grieving. So sometimes allowing herself the space, the freedom, and making allowances for her own style of grief being different than others is important. Let's look at the next scenario here of Charles. Charles comes to you for counseling for his depression. He walks in with a cane, struggling to move as he limps. He recalls years of being a football star in high school, college, and beyond, until a metal beam injured him at his factory job. Now all he can do is watch football from the sidelines and recall years past. His whole identity is not the same anymore. He feels stuck, limited, restrained, with few options of being the adventurous person he once was. How would you approach counseling with this man? Remember that oftentimes when we're talking about mourning and loss, it's not always a death, a literal death, like an end of life, but it can be an end of a dream or an end of a value. We all have ideas about our goals in life or what we think potentially could happen. And when those are shattered, especially in such a extreme way and a sudden way, as in this case of Charles, where the metal beam hit him at work, I mean, it just turns your world upside down. I would probably talk with him about his value of being adventurous. There's real grief in the sense of if he can't move as freely as he did before, adventure might need to be redefined. And that's something that we ended up having to talk about. Let's look at the case of Angelina. Angelina was at school one day playing with her best friend Marie. Before long, though, Marie did not come to school often. She came a few days, then left a few days. Something must be going on, thought Angelina. All the teacher said was that Marie was having to get some treatment and be at home to do her schoolwork in between things, but would come back when she felt better. Focusing on learning was not the same without her friend's smiling face in the classroom. Recess was less fun. Angelina felt lost without her sidekick. They did everything together. After some days away, Marie would come back to school, but only for a matter of days again. The hope would start back. Maybe this time Marie will stay longer, thought Angelina. But sometimes it went for weeks, and even 1 month. One day the teacher announced that Marie would not be coming back to school and needed to do her schoolwork at home, but the students could send cards to Marie. It was uncertain if Marie would ever be back. What was this mystery sickness Marie had? Would she catch it? How could it make people disappear for days or maybe even forever? Angelina wondered. Well, a lot of layers here. Keep in mind that changes with mourning and loss aren't always those we think of. It could be change of a best friend. It could be change of a routine. It could be a transition from the way things were done before to try and figure out a new way. And sometimes when things are open-ended like this, it falls in that category again of the disenfranchised grief of, it's possible that maybe my friend will never be back. I don't have the answer. I don't know what's ever going to happen. And for this young child, there are more questions than answers. Sometimes actually getting the information that's meaningful to the person can be a help. Sometimes finding out what they're asking behind the question might be important. Now, depending on the personality, the developmental level, and other factors, we might want to try some play therapy with Angelina. There could be some art and drawing therapy. Some of that phototherapy might be interesting too. If this was a playmate of hers and her best friend, she might have some pictures on her phone or something maybe mom took at a birthday party or a school event, and we could talk through that. There's a lot of meaning making we have to remember that even children do on their young level. One of the things that sometimes we forget is that parents use these metaphors about mourning and loss, and they're not helpful. The more specific, maybe not super detailed, but just enough on a developmental level to answer a question of a child, things are, the better that can be for that child. So helping her sort through that. The change of Angelina's friend, Marie, might also be something we need to explore in terms of who are the support systems? What does skill development look like in terms of making or keeping other friends? Maybe Angelina's comparing other students in the classroom about how are they going to be compared to Marie. They're not her. Well, what if I make a friend? What if I lose them? We also hear focusing on learning is not the same. So helping her through that. A lot of times when there's mourning and loss, we might need to look at the practical side of things. Let's look at this next scenario of Marcus. Finally accepted, Marcus thought, as a teenager who hoped for years to fit in somewhere, he finally found a group of friends he clicked with. Things appeared to be normal for once. One day, Marcus's parents sat him down, saying he had some news to share. Something happened with his dad's company he worked at that was called a buyout. New people took over. At first, that did not sound so bad to Marcus. As the story continued, Marcus was told that the new people coming in were replacing his dad and the workers that already worked there had to also leave. This meant his dad was without a job. There's plenty of jobs, Marcus thought. No problem, my dad's a nice guy and a hard worker. But Marcus's mom explained that with the family needs for Marcus and his siblings, the bills and private education fees, a new direction would have to be taken. This meant a move to another state. While Marcus's parents tried to be encouraging about Marcus's ability to make a new group of friends again, Marcus was not so sure. All he knew was that he believed his parents were selfish and did not care about disrupting his life. Change is difficult, especially imposed change. While we're working with Marcus, we may want to start by identifying some of the feelings that he's going through. I bet that one of the main ones is unfairness. So he's probably not looking at what his dad's going through and the changes or the difficulties of the decisions the parents had to make. But he's looking at the inconvenience of, finally I get friends and you ruin it for me. He's not looking at, my parents want me to go to a good school or to pay, they want to be able to pay bills. He's looking at, gosh, what a disruption. And it sounds like there's resentment, there's anger. There may be, in some of our situations where we deal with clients, a sense of resentment, of anger, a sense of, you know, why do you get to have control over my life? Why do you get to decide this for me? There may be this sense with Marcus of, you know, that stuckness of being a teenager, like, great, So no matter what, I'm not going to get what I need. I'm forced into this. It could be really important for us to do some good work with a system about how the parents are responding to Marcus's grief. Are they normalizing it? Are they hearing it out or not? So I'd like to do a quick summary of some of the topics we talked about today regarding this important topic of grieving with grace. We talked about some of the elements of being a grief counselor. So having specialized skills, empathy, being able to hear the individualized narrative of the client. We talked about how there is no one right linear path. There is no step-by-step. This stage, then that stage that clients go through. That some components that they may report at any given time are shock, disorganization, a search for making meaning out of something that just can be challenging, or a host of emotional components, sadness, tears, anger, anxiety, resentments, and other emotions. There may be sense of regret of I would have, I should have, I could have, such and such. We talk about framing it not so much as letting go, that eventually a client gets to a point where things are better and they never think about it again, but as more of one of reintegrating, reassigning meaning, re-putting things into context. I mentioned an author called Alan Wolfelt who talked about the six needs of mourning. And we talked about how when we're dealing with grief, it's not just counseling, but many other collateral services that may be needed. So it may be quite important for us to have clients sign releases of consent so we can do some consultation with other types of professionals in the community. Many factors influence how our clients do mourning, grief, and loss. From how close a person was, how much a value meant to them, their religious beliefs, their gender, what support systems they have or don't have. One of the best things we can do is give ourselves permission to do the grief work at the pace and in the way he or she needs it. We need to reinforce that their individualized grief is legitimate and that we will honor their personal narrative of what that looks like. That the healing pathway might have some ebbs and flows between shock, disorganization, and reorganization, but that we're committed to being through the process with them of reclaiming the circumstances, of working through things. I use the poem For Each Thorn to help give a sense of perspective that oftentimes the roses grow alongside the thorns. For each pain, for each hurt, for each open-endedness in life, for each unfairness, that there is also beauty, and it's really hard to sort through that. One of the cognitions that we often have to work through with our clients is the idea of sometimes unexpected things or unpleasant things happen to people that are very well intentioned. And sometimes people who make mistakes actually have great things happen in life. That life is not as linear as we would like. We talked about the importance of avoiding the extremes of enshrining someone, kind of putting them on a pedestal as we process through grief, or bedevilment of really getting stuck in anger and resentment. We talked about the importance of placing memories and learning how to reconceptualize things. Grief has a place. Meaning making is a real struggle for many, many people. And actually, as much of a struggle as it is, the literature suggests that it has a significant place in transforming clients' narratives for the better in the long run. It helps them develop short and long-term goals. It helps them become resilient, which is only possible sometimes through stress and suffering. It can be growth-producing and even lead some people to thriving. It helps them find the light in the darkness, so to speak. There are behaviors that we can help our clients do in terms of concrete things that help them move beyond to a healthier place, moving beyond the why questions to what and how. We can help them identify support systems as well as what behaviors they need from the support system. I use the idea of that story of the individualized grief with the carrot, the egg, and cup of coffee to illustrate that there's different ways we all respond to grief. Sometimes we respond by toughening up. Sometimes we respond by getting harder. And sometimes we affect the environment around us. We can use stories such as this, such as the one I mentioned about the parable of the cave, and other stories as metaphors that sometimes our clients can relate to that makes it easier for them to talk about than maybe directly talking about the pain. Narrative approaches can help clients to come up with restoring a more desired narrative and approach for the future. We talked about when it's appropriate using things like the empty chair technique to give an opportunity for a client to work through what might be unresolved business or solutions in a session. I suggested that we do this early on in a session because we want to make sure ethically that we have the client de-escalated by the time he or she leaves. There's ways that we can incorporate photos, technologies, memories in terms of restoring and working through with our clients. We have things like shame that we can process through. A lot of times when we're dealing with the narratives and trying to sort through and do meaning making, shame is a very real component. People may have a tendency to blame themselves, to personalize things, or to feed on fears rather than look in the context of things. So we may have to assist them. We also may have to assist them in working beyond the bumper sticker answers, the automatic, maybe well-intentioned comments of people. Cognitive behavioral therapy is another sort of therapy that can be helpful to our clients, where we help identify the irrational cognitions and unhelpful behaviors, and then help them apply these cognitive debating skills. We talked about the unique considerations of working with children and looking at their developmental age, their personality, and keeping in mind that 75% of children have very real fears of loss. Play therapy can be an excellent modality to help move beyond some of the grief, loss, and mourning with children. We also talked about forgiveness and offenses because a lot of times there's unfinished business and things to sort through regarding regrets and hurts and pains when it comes to loss and mourning. We actually have the ability to instill hope in our clients and talked about some hopeful elements. We also talked about resiliency as being a skill that can be developed. And that vulnerability isn't necessarily a bad thing. I want to thank you for spending time with me and joining me for this seminar on Grieving with Grace. Please remember that the board requires a mandatory test, which can be found on the website at www.rolpc.org. Again, that's www.rolpc.org. When you go to the home study test page on the River of Life Professional Counseling website, it will take you to a form, and that form is automatically emailed to us. Once you receive it, it is date and time stamped, so the certificate for completion of this course will be sent to you with the date that is time stamped on your completed test. If you have any questions or suggestions for future seminars, feel free to contact us here at River of Life Professional Counseling. Thank you, and we wish you well in the field.